Welcome to the deep dive. So you know when you have a plant near a window and you see it leaning, like really leaning towards the light?
Yeah, phototropism. It looks so simple, almost passive.
Right. But it turns out that simple lean, well, it's actually driven by some really complex decision-making happening inside the plant.
Exactly. And that's what we're diving into today, looking specifically at a pretty detailed college lecture by Dr. Ty C.M. Hoffman on how plants actually perceive and react to their world.
Yeah, our goal here is to kind of unpack what Dr. Hoffman presented, going from these basic observations people made centuries ago all the way to, you know, complex molecular stuff and defenses.
Right. We're trying to answer that core question Dr. Hoffman posed. How do plants know what signals they're getting, internal or external, and how do they use that info to survive?
So let's start with a really obvious one. Phototropism. The bending towards light. We know why they do a photosynthesis, but the how.
Yeah.
That was the puzzle.
And that's where Charles Darwin and his son Francis came in. They did some foundational work using corn seedlings, specifically the little protective sheath called the coleoptile.
Their experiments were, well, pretty clever for the time.
They were. They found that if they just snipped off the very tip of the seedling, it stopped bending. Just grew straight up.
Like it couldn't see the light anymore?
Exactly. And same result if they covered that tip with a tiny opaque cap. No light hits the tip. No bending.
Okay, but here's the really interesting bit Dr. Hoffman highlighted. If they covered the lower part, the part that actually does the bending, with an opaque sleeve,
but left the tip exposed,
it's still bent.
That was the key. It proved, as Dr. Hoffman explained, that the tip receives the light signal, but the response, the bending, happens further down. So there must be a signal traveling from the tip.
Which leads right to the next question. What is that signal? Is it chemical? Electrical?
Yeah. And that's where Boyce and Jensen picked up the baton. They refined the experiments. They cut the tip off again, but this time put a little block of gelatin between the tip and the stump.
Gelatin.
Mm.
That's porous, right? Chemicals can move through it.
Precisely. And guess what? The plant still bent towards the light. So something diffusible was passing through the gelatin.
Okay, okay. But how did they know for sure it was chemical?
Ah, the control experiment. They swapped the gelatin for a thin piece of mica, you know, that flaky rock. It's totally impermeable.
Nothing gets through.
Right. And with the mica block in place, no bending. That really sealed the deal. The signal had to be chemical.
But Dr. Hoffman mentioned an ultimate test. What was that?
This was the clincher. They took a severed tip, let it sit on a little cube of agar, like a nutrient jelly, for a while, presumably letting the chemicals seep into it.
Okay.
Then they tossed the tip away and put just the agar cube, the one that had soaked up the signal, onto the decapitated seedling stump.
Yeah.
It bent. The stump bent as if the tip was still there sending the signal.
Wow. So the chemical itself was enough.
That, right there, Dr. Hoffman identified as the first real experimental proof of a plant hormone. A chemical made in one spot travels and causes an effect somewhere else, like a little internal postal service.
And this whole idea of a chemical signal binding to a receptor, that's fundamental in biology, isn't it? Not just plants.
Absolutely universal. You have the signal molecule, the ligand, and it has to fit perfectly into its specific receptor, like a key in a lock. The shape has to be just right.
And Dr. Hoffman made a point that these receptors are always proteins. Why proteins?
Well, think about it. Proteins are made from 20 different amino acid building blocks. That allows them to fold into an almost unbelievable variety of complex, specific 3D shapes.
So they make perfect, unique locks for those chemical keys.
Exactly. That versatility is key.
Okay, so hormones exist. Let's get into the major ones Dr. Hoffman covered. There were six main types, starting with the one they just discovered. Auxin, IAA, right?
Indole acetic acid, IAA. Yep, that's the stuff that was in the agar cubes, responsible for that bending, the phototropism. But it does more than just bending.
Like what?
Well, it stimulates the cells in the stem to elongate, to stretch out. Though Dr. Hoffman noted it only works well at low concentrations. It also encourages lateral roots to form.
And the big one, the one you can really see, is apical dominance. If you're a gardener, you know this one.
Oh, definitely. The very top bud, the apical bud, pumps out auxin. That auxin flows downwards and basically tells the side buds, the axillary buds, nope, don't grow yet.
Which is why plants tend to grow tall and skinny initially.
Right. And it's why, as you said, if you nip the tip, literally remove that top bud, you break the auxin's dominance. Suddenly those side buds get the green light to grow and the plant bushes out.
Makes sense.
Okay.
A nest hormone, cytokinins. The name sounds like it gives it away.
It pretty much does. Cytokinins are named for cytokinesis cell division. Their main job is regulating that process, promoting the creation of new cells, driving growth.
Then we hit gibberellins.
Yeah.
What's their main role?
Big time stem elongation, and they're also critical for pollen development. Dr. Hoffman gave a great practical example using them on table grapes.
Right, I remember that. It makes the grapes bigger, obviously, but there's another reason.
Yes. It also makes the little stems within the cluster, the internodes, grow longer. This spaces the grapes out.
Ah, so they're not all jammed together. Better air circulation.
Exactly. Less crowding means less chance of mold and just a better looking bunch for the market. It's a chemical fix for a physical problem.
Dr. Hoffman also talked about their role in germination. This got a bit detailed. When a seed gets wet.
Right, think of the inside of the seed, the endosperm, as stored food, mostly starch. The baby plant, the embryo, needs sugar, glucose, to start growing, especially if it's underground in the dark.
So how does he get the sugar?
When water comes in, the embryo releases gibberellins. These hormones travel to a special layer called the alarone layer and signal it to start making an enzyme, alpha amylase.
Amylase.
Eh.
That breaks down starch.
You got it. The alpha amylase chops up the stored starch into glucose, providing the fuel the embryo needs to push out of the seed coat. It's a really neat timed release system.
Okay. Next, brassinosteroids. Dr. Hoffman called them plant steroids.
Yeah, phytosterols. They're structurally similar to animal steroid hormones, but specific to plants. They also promote cell expansion and division.
And they have that concentration thing too, like auxin.
They do. Dr. Hoffman pointed out low levels can promote root growth, but high levels actually inhibit it. It's all about balance.
The big inhibitor, abscisic acid, ABA. And Dr. Hoffman said the name is wrong.
A classic misnomer.
Aye.
It was named because scientists initially thought it caused abscission leaf fall.
But it doesn't.
Not primarily. We now know it's mainly a growth inhibitor. Its huge roles are in keeping seeds dormant, kind of in suspended animation until conditions are right, and, crucially, signaling the stomata, the leaf pores, to close up during drought to save water.
That's vital, and the counterexample was mangroves.
Right. Mangrove seeds often germinate while still attached to the parent tree. It's called fizipary. Dr. Hoffman explained this happens because they have very, very low levels of ABA. They lack that chemical break that keeps most seeds dormant.
Fascinating. Okay, last one, ethylene. This one's famous.
And chemically, the simplest. It's just a gas, C2H4. Like nitric oxide in us, it's a simple gas used as a signal.
And everyone knows it for ripening
Yeah.
fruit, right? The banana and the paper bag trick.
Exactly. Bananas release a lot of ethylene, which speeds up the ripening of other fruits nearby. Conversely, those green bags for produce are designed to absorb ethylene to slow ripening down.
And Dr. Hoffman clarified that ethylene is actually involved in leaf drop, the abscission thing.
Yes, specifically the ratio of ethylene to auxin.
Yep.
When ethylene levels get high relative to auxin, that's the trigger for the leaf to fall off.
Okay, we have the players, the hormones. Now, how do they do things like auxin causing bending the acid growth hypothesis? How does that work?
Right, so auxin accumulates on the shaded side of the stem. There, it activates these little molecular machines called proton pumps in the cell membranes.
Proton pumps. They pump protons, hydrogen ions, H+ lines.
Exactly. They start pumping H+ ions out of the cell cytoplasm and into the space within the cell wall.
What does pumping hydrogen ions out achieve?
Two things. First, it makes that cell wall space more acidic, lowers the pH. Second, that acidic environment activates certain enzymes already present in the wall that start snipping the connections between the cellulose fibers.
So it literally loosens the cell wall structure.
Precisely. It makes the wall more flexible, more extensible.
But why does the cell get longer, not just like fatter?
Ah, that's the directional part, Dr. Hoffman emphasized. Because the auxin, and therefore the active proton pumps, are concentrated on the shaded side, only those side walls loosen significantly. Then, water pressure inside the cell, turgor, pushes outwards, and since the side walls are loose, the cell is forced to elongate primarily in one direction.
Making the whole stem curve away from the shade towards the light.
Yeah.
Clever.
Very. It's a purely biochemical and physical process driving that movement.
Okay, let's shift from growth to sensing, light sensing. Dr. Hoffman mentioned two main receptor types.
Right. First, the blue light receptors. As the name suggests, they're most sensitive to blue light, and they are the primary drivers for that phototropic bending we started with.
And the second type?
The phytochromes. These respond to red and far red light. And Dr. Hoffman described them as basically the plant's molecular light switch for timing and detecting shade.
They flip-flop between two forms, right? PR and PSR.
Exactly. Text absorbs red light and instantly converts to the text form. Then text 4 absorbs far red light and snaps back to text. It's a reversible switch.
And this switching tells the plant about its light environment. How does that work for survival, say, under trees?
Think about sunlight filtering through a canopy of leaves. The chlorophyll in those upper leaves absorbs most of the red light, but lets the far red light pass through.
So down on the forest floor, it's relatively rich in far red light.
Right. A seedling down there gets hit with lots of far red light. This flips its phytochrome population mostly into the inactive text state. That high texture level is the signal. Warning, you are shaded. Grow tall, fast. It triggers rapid stem elongation to reach better light.
That's brilliant. Using the quality of light, not just the quantity.
It's incredibly sophisticated sensing.
And plants use light for timing too, right? Daily rhythms.
Yep, circadian rhythms. Dr. Hoffman mentioned things like leaves changing position between day and night. These are internal, roughly 24-hour clocks, but they get reset or entrained by the daily light cycle to stay accurate.
And yearly rhythms for things like flowering.
Circannual rhythms. Plants need to time reproduction carefully. Dr. Hoffman stressed they don't use unreliable cues like temperature. They measure the length of the day, or more accurately, the length of the uninterrupted night.
The short day versus long day plant. So it's really about night length.
Exactly. A short day plant is really a long night plant. It needs a dark period longer than some critical threshold to flower.
And florists exploit this.
They do. If you have a long night plant, you can prevent it from flowering even during winter just by interrupting that long night with a brief flash of light. That flash resets the phytochrome switch.
And Dr. Hoffman confirmed it is the phytochromes, the red far red system, controlling this flowering response.
Yes, specifically the phytochromes are the timekeepers for flowering.
Okay, moving on from light, gravity. Gravitropism. Roots down, shoots up. How do they know?
It's pretty cool. Inside specific cells, especially in the root cap, Dr. Hoffman explained, are these dense little organelles called statoliths. They're basically sacs filled with starch granules.
Starch is heavy.
Relatively, yes. So due to gravity, these statoliths settle down onto the lowest part of the cell membrane.
Like little weights falling down.
Exactly. And where they press triggers, signals that tell the root this way is down.
And Dr. Hoffman drew a parallel to us.
Yeah, to the otoliths, the tiny calcium carbonate crystals, ear rocks in our inner ear. They settle based on gravity and head movements, telling our brain about balance and orientation. Same principle, different system.
Nature finds similar solutions. Mm-hmm. What about touch? Thigmotropism.
Right. Plants respond to physical contact. Dr. Hoffman mentioned that repeatedly touching or stroking a plant can make it grow shorter and stockier, likely as a defense against wind or physical damage.
And the classic example is the mimosa plant, the sensitive clam.
Oh, yeah. You touch its leaves, and the leaflets fold up almost instantly.
How does it do that so fast? No muscles.
It's electrical. Well, sort of. Dr. Hoffman described it as rapid changes in electrical potential across cell membranes, slower than our nerve impulses, but similar in principle. These voltage changes cause ions to rush in or out of specialized motor cells at the base of the leaflets.
And that changes the water pressure.
Drastically and quickly. It causes a rapid loss of turgor pressure in those motor cells, making the leaflets collapse or fold. It's a hydraulic movement triggered electrically.
Amazing. Okay, last big section from Dr. Hoffman. Dealing with stress. Environmental and biological. Plants are just passive victims.
Far from it. Take environmental stress. Drought. We mentioned ABA closing stomata. Flooding. That means no oxygen for the roots. Some plants, like mangroves, have evolved specialized root structures, like snorkels, to get air down below the waterline.
What about salt stress, like near the ocean?
High salt outside the roots tries to pull water out by osmosis. Plants counter this by actively pumping ions into their root cells or synthesizing organic solutes to make the inside of the cell saltier than the outside, keeping water flowing in or at least not flowing out.
Fighting osmosis with osmosis.
Yeah.
Heat stress, proteins denature.
Right. Heat can wreck enzymes. So plants under heat stress produce heat shock proteins. These are like alternate versions of essential proteins, but folded in a way that makes them stable and functional at higher temperatures.
And cold stress. Two big problems there, right? Ice crystals and stiff membranes.
Yep. Ice crystals inside cells are deadly. So plants produce antifreeze proteins that interfere with ice formation. And to keep membranes fluid in the cold, they change the membrane's recipe.
How
They increase the proportion of unsaturated fatty acids in their membranes. These fatty acids have kinks in their tails, which prevents the molecules from packing tightly together, keeping the membrane loose and fluid even when it's cold.
Like adding kinks to keep things from freezing solid. Okay, finally, biological defense. Dr. Hoffman's caterpillar story.
That was wild.
It really illustrates the complexity. Caterpillar starts chewing a leaf. The plant detects both the physical damage and specific chemicals in the caterpillar's saliva.
It knows what is eating it.
It seems so. And it responds by synthesizing and releasing specific volatile chemicals into the air. Volatile means they evaporate easily, become airborne signals.
Correct. And these aren't just general alarm signals. In the case Dr. Hoffman described, the specific blend of volatiles released attracts a particular species of parasitic wasp.
A wasp that preys on that caterpillar.
Exactly. The wasp follows the chemical trail, finds the caterpillar, and lays its eggs inside it. The wasp larvae then consume the caterpillar from within.
So the plant basically calls in an airstrike on its attacker. That's wow.
It's chemical communication coordinating three different species. Plant, herbivore, predator, truly sophisticated.
And beyond calling for help, plants have their own internal immune responses.
Definitely. If a pathogen like a fungus or a bacterium infects a leaf, the plant often triggers the hypersensitive response right at the infection site.
What does that involve?
The plant essentially sacrifices those infected cells and the ones immediately around them. It triggers programmed cell death to create a dead zone, walling off the pathogen so it can't spread.
A scorched earth tactic on a cellular level.
Pretty much, but it doesn't stop there. Those dying cells also release a signal, likely hormonal.
A warning signal?
Yes, a signal that travels throughout the rest of the plant, triggering systemic acquired resistance, or SAR. It's like the plant is priming the defenses in all the healthy leaves, getting them ready in case the pathogen shows up there. It's a form of plant-wide immunity boost.
What an incredible journey. We went from just watching a plant lean towards the sun to seeing these intricate chemical signals, molecular light switches, internal clocks, and even multi-species defense packs.
I think the main message from Dr. Hoffman's lecture is just how dynamic and, well, active plants are. They're constantly sensing dozens of signals, hormones, light, gravity, touch, water levels, attackers, and integrating all that information to fine-tune their growth and survival second by second.
They're chemical wizards, really. Far more complex than they appear sitting there in a pot.
Absolutely. They're masters of biochemistry.
And it makes you wonder, thinking about those volatile attractants, those simple gases like ethylene, we're just starting to decipher this chemical language. What other conversations are happening out there?
Between plants, or plants and insects, or even microbes.
Yeah. What airborne signals are drifting around your garden or the park right now that are carrying crucial information, but we're completely unaware because we just don't have the right receptors to sense them?
That's a great thought to leave with. What's happening in that silent green world that we haven't even begun to perceive? Something to ponder next time you're looking at a tree?